again?
Yes.
I have a question.
Sure. I'm going to say real quick, this is side two, or part two, of Love, Power, and Serenity, lecture 84. Go ahead.
When you say that the power type or the will type is afraid of being helpless,
mm-hmm.
That really resonates with me, and I can see the fear and the terror of that feeling helpless.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think of helplessness, I think that's a very negative way or negative emotion. What would be the positive or the divine side of being helpless?
Okay, great question. What I really do is I play with this. And because I am an aggressive type, I tend to talk, and I sometimes don't listen for other contributions, so sometimes you have to whack me on the head to get your two words in. But the positive of helplessness would be to experience vulnerability.
Okay.
Let me describe it this way. There's a place of, we used to call it in class, I don't know why, but my class came up with this example, we used it every year for 8 years, of going through the hoop of fire, of discovering that something that you were afraid of wasn't going to kill you. So helplessness per se isn't an infant helpless. A human infant left on its own has zero chance for survival. It is totally and completely helpless.
Mm-hmm.
And in that state, an infant can learn that it can depend on other people to give it what it needs. Now, I'm talking in the extreme. Of course, we don't get everything we need, and we resent that for the rest of our lives. But if you're speaking on this phone, if you're walking and talking, somebody gave you the basic essential that human beings need to function. And so when you were at your absolute most helpless stage on this planet, you were not left on your own. And the degree to which we got met during that period, which is infant, you know, obviously infant and child psychology, from a spiritual perspective, that emblazoned us with an attitude around being helpless. So you were asking what the positive of helplessness would be. And that's one example. I'll give you another. I had an experience once on a hike that I'm going to analogize. I did not do basic training. I was never in the military. But because I had an experience on a hike, I extrapolate and I began to have a deep understanding of how military forces create such a strong bond in a fighting group. And by going through the basic training, breaking people down, showing them that they can't climb out of the mud, they can't scale the wall, they can't keep up, they'll always give you a task that is more than you can possibly accomplish, they'll figure out what you can do and assign you 120%. By taking you to the place or you can't do it, and having your team members reach out and help you is a tremendous bonding process. Now, I learned that on a hike when my electrolytes got out of balance and I started feeling dizzy and I thought I'd have to quit and go back. And somebody said, no, we can help. And I realized that I had never in my life accepted help on that, on a physical level like that, since I was an infant. And in accepting their help and a little humility, because I was a little prideful, and realizing that this hypoglycemic condition would pass and allowing them to take my backpack and not running away from the situation. I learned a profound lesson that allowing people to help me, number one, it didn't kill me. Secondly, it didn't make me a baby. Thirdly, people didn't look down on me. That was in my mind. People were glad to help. They enjoyed being able to help me. And these particular people on the hike knew about the situation. They'd seen it before. It wasn't a drama to them. They were really cool with it. It was I had the problem. So those are two or three examples that I can give you of where becoming helpless can be a place of tremendous learning about yourself and your attitudes, and also about the willingness of others to reach out and give you a hand. So another example is the catastrophes that we've seen in various places on the planet. Yes, we've seen people who normally wake up in the morning and go to work and drive their car and take care of their families, totally devastated, completely and utterly devastated, to the point where they need food and water. And we don't feel high and mighty about getting food and water to them. In fact, it makes us feel good to be able to help other people. So when we talk about being helpless, we're really speaking from a very egocentric perspective. If we come out of that, remember I talked about the three spheres, this would be in the place of the individual self-sphere, where we're only concerned about us, and we don't care what the other person's learning. If we come out of that tight little bubble, and we see where our helplessness allows other people to reach into the depth of their character, and learn something about themselves, and learn to bring more love forward for their fellow man, that's where helplessness can become a tremendous positive. Now, does that kind of help you out there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the helpless part?
Mm-hmm.
I hope so. Okay. So it's a game that I play, a little bit of a devil's advocate. Whenever I used to, being human, I used to point at other people and say, you don't see the pro perspective, so you believe one thing, but I have another point of view, and let me explain to you how both can have validity. And then, of course, one day I realized that perhaps I should use this on my own pet projects and my own beliefs that I hold very dear and have a grip around, a tight, tight fist around my own beliefs. And that's a little harder to allow for the possibility that there's another perspective and that I could be wrong. But it's tremendous spiritual exercise to undergo, to play as devil's advocate with yourself. And this is why in finding our distortions, that's the positive of finding them. How can you fix what you cannot see? So I use another lecture when I teach. I use the lecture 127, which is the four stages of evolution. And what that lecture talks about is 4 points. And the first four stages. The first stage is automatic reflex. And that means you don't know. If you don't know, you're being mean. You can't do a lot about it. The second stage is awareness, and that's where you become aware that you're being mean. Notice you're still being mean, but awareness begins to come through, and that's what happens when we train children, when we raise children. We're trying to bring to them an awareness of a larger set of needs or a larger set of priorities or a larger world than just, I want my biscuit now. So you have automatic reflex where you don't know what's going on, means you can't do anything about it. Then you have awareness, and all awareness shows you is that something's not right. It's painful when it's not right, and you don't know what to do about it yet. Then the third stage is understanding. These aren't discrete. There's no hard, thick, magic marker line between these stages. They're very, very fluid. And they're not only very fluid, they happen, you can be in different stages in different aspects of your life on this. And the third stage is understanding. And it is in the understanding that we can soften the pain of awareness, where you can learn, yes, I am being mean, but you know what? I'm not mean all the time. But I am mean in a particular situation, and I'm going to begin the process of understanding why I'm triggered to be mean in a given situation. And the last stage in Lecture 127's four stages is knowing. And in the knowing, it's like the psychic nuclear point. In the knowing, we're done. I know I'm mean on occasion. I understand it. I have done things about it. When people bring it to my awareness, I will act immediately on it because I understand completely that it is possible. I have an understanding of where it comes from, and I have an understanding of how to support and counteract this unfortunate tendency of mine to be selfish in a given circumstance. So what I'm reaching for here is that it isn't the inherent issue. It isn't the inherent distortion. It's not who you are or where you came from. It's not where you've been headed or where you've... nothing is inherently positive or negative. And it can all be dealt with. It can all be worked with. It's all material. But in order for you to understand why you're behaving in a certain way, you may need some information. And some of that information goes back to childhood, and some of it goes back to yesterday. So the example was given on submitting and selling something to somebody you care about at a lower price. Such a simple little thing. But if you've done it once, you may have done it 20 times, and you may not have caught the other 19. But just because you don't remember the other 19 doesn't mean you're not irritated by them. You cannot intellectually remember 19 other incidents. But emotionally, whenever a situation comes up again, it's like Pavlovian dog stuff. You're programmed to think, this is going to hurt. I'm going to sell myself out. This is going to be unpleasant. This is going to even get worse. In that moment of awareness, and the moment that was described was very luscious, because not only was awareness realized, but there was an understanding. This is not a good thing. This is not a simple thing. This is not a small thing. And giving in on this is not real love. Let's go back to a moment to the distortion of submission. When I give in to you, I'm not being me. And so what am I giving you? I'm giving you a mask. I'm giving you an image. And because I'm a full-blooded human being, there's a part of me that knows that and resents it. So I'm not only not giving you me, I'm setting up an area of resentment in me that could affect our future relationship together. That's not a loving thing to do. Now, if you move over into power, from the position of wanting power so that I won't be helpless, because I've decided helpless is bad and no good will come of it and I will be destroyed. You've got to get that it's not just helpless. It's that other series of attitudes attached to it. So if I give in to you, I become more and more helpless and I lose ground. And so... lost report for a second. Happens sometimes. Just comes on me. Let me breathe for a second. So we're talking about how that's not really loving to submit. It's also not loving to try to take care of yourself and your own helplessness under the guise of strength when we say that's for somebody else. That's why I lost it, because it's a little confusing. It's a little kind of, I call them double backflip. So when I exercise power and I say it's for the good of all, and the truth is it's not for the good of all, it's for the good of me, that's also not loving. That doesn't allow me to be me. And if, for instance, I took leadership with that attitude, you would have a leader that you wouldn't really know. So there's a bit of a con job going on there. So these are where these attributes that could be used for good, that could be used neutrally or positively, when they're used negatively, they don't serve the person using them, and they don't serve others. And at some point in this lecture, the guide says, and it's a favorite thing of mine, so I notice when the guide says something I really agree with, what he says is that sometimes it's easier to notice it in others. And when we're studying personality, I believe that it is sometimes easier to notice mask and idealized self-image. It's easier to notice false submissiveness. It's easier to notice where somebody is withdrawing. Haven't talked about that yet. Where somebody is withdrawing and pulling away simply because they don't want to get hurt, not because it's the appropriate thing to do, but because they don't have the tools to deal with it, and so they want to pull out and pretend it's not happening. So it's easier to see those moments when we're looking at somebody else. And what I teach is, let that be appropriate for you. If you can see it by looking at someone else, great. It's more important to really get a picture of the concept than in the cycle or the order in which you learn it. But the other thing, which comes in again at the end of this lecture, when the guide says you cannot generalize, he's saying that because the situation always comes down to the individual and their work. So when you learn something about a concept such as false submission, and you learn it because you see it being enacted by another, that's not the end of the work. This is not an intellectual exercise. The other half of the work is to bring that concept in and to find out in your own self where you submit. And when I went through my notes, I found a place where what it felt like to me was the guide says that the key to learning this is to actually notice a void. So in other words, it's really, really interesting if the guide says that we all have parts of these and we all participate in all these distortions and we all have pieces of will, pieces of emotion, and pieces of reason in terms of personality type. If you cannot see one of these concepts in yourself, this should raise an alarm bell. As long as you can see it a little bit, that may be all there is. It just may not be where you go into distortion very much. But the key is, if you can't see it at all, you may be hiding from yourself. You may not be being honest. So again, it's useful to look outside and see in the great big wide world all these terrible distortions. But finishing up the work involves coming in and saying, where do I submit? Where do I try to power through things because it makes me nervous to saunter? Makes me nervous to walk slowly. I don't know if any of you have ever had to perform in any way where you needed to walk very slowly across a stage to receive a diploma or in some circumstances where a lot of people are watching you and you're supposed to walk very slowly. And my experience was I can't walk straight. I'm rolling on my feet, and I don't really know how to walk slowly, smoothly, and gracefully. Okay? Well, it's interesting. When you slow yourself down, this is where you can find some of these elements of distortion, because they may hide under, we have to take care of it. We have to do it this way. We don't have time to think about this. This is a must. These intellectual justifications and rationalizations that say, don't question it, this is just the way it is. That's a way of moving briskly. But taking it apart and saying, what if we don't? What if we don't do this today? Will the sky fall? When we hear the little voice saying, yes, yes, the sky will fall, that's important. That's an important voice for you to find. Where, if you take off your mask, will you not be loved? Where, if you stop driving through things, will you become helpless? And then we turn to the third distortion, which is withdrawal. And in withdrawal, withdrawal is about not being able to cope with the conflicting needs that go on in terms of being a human being. So the reason type would like there to be order and serenity and tables and graphs and proof, and you know what's true and you know what's false, not because you want to win, you just know where they are. It's the reason type. Okay? Order is what reason types are looking for. Human beings are a terrible place to look for order, because we are chaotic and things happen irrationally and for no reason. We're a mess. And when reason types try to deal with conflicting human feelings and situations and find that there is no way to resolve it, they might withdraw. And withdrawal is the pseudo-solution to try to create the false mask of serenity. So there's nothing wrong with serenity. Serenity is fabulous if it's true. But false serenity, a pretense that there is order when there is not, is actually a very subtle unplugging from reality. So everybody I know has gone numb sometimes when things get out of control, when there are too many opinions, when there's when very, very important things are happening and they don't have time to research and they just have to make a choice and let it go, and they have this gut feeling that choice may not be the best choice, but they don't know what to do. It's really, really hard for every single person, and I was coming so close to it, I was going to try to avoid it, but there's no way to avoid it, so I'm going to move right into this financial situation on the globe. Is one of those hideously complicated messes. And we as a culture, a global culture and individual nation cultures, we haven't been here before. We've seen similar experiences, but we've never seen it to this magnitude. And so nobody really has a magic bullet. Everybody's guessing. And they're guessing with incredible amounts of money that have zeros that are dizzying. And if at some point you notice that you just don't watch the news, and you just don't read the papers, and you just don't get involved, and you just don't think about it, this could be a very subtle form of withdrawal. May also be good for your mental health. We all need a break sometimes. But I'm not talking, remember in the beginning we were talking about an alternating flow, like the tide flows in and the tide flows out. You breathe in and you breathe out. you read four or five papers in a row, you watch a certain number of documentaries, you watch the news, and then you say, oh, I need a break. I need to go away for the weekend, I need to take some time off, and then I'll be refreshed, and I'll come back, and I'll see what I can do, which may not be much. This would be completely different than an artificial withdrawal that basically says, don't understand money, don't want to talk about it. Okay? Because that's not true. Everybody understands money. We may not understand high finance. But when our lives are on the line and our, you know, this is part of our culture, we need to all pitch in and help together, it's important to understand. So what I'm describing is the distortion of withdrawal rather than the ebb and flow and the alternating need to engage, withdraw, and refresh. Engage, withdraw, and refresh. And the reason type who needs order, who sees that order is important for them to function in. This may not be the best example, but some people just can't relax in a messy room. They just can't do it. You put them in a messy room and they pick up the clutter and they may even clean. That's what they do. But this is just a tiny sliver of the reason type of needing an orderly environment to be able to sweep the room and see where things are, to be able to reliably go and open a drawer and get the pens from that drawer and not have to spend a half an hour running around the house trying to find a ballpoint pen. So everybody has elements of the reason personality type. Everybody has some degree. So everybody has, to some degree, a need for order. But when order is imposed as a pseudo-solution, as a false solution to a problem, that's when it's gone into distortion. So when you cannot function, you simply cannot function with a fork out of place, time to look at yourself. Okay, because if that level of order puts you off your stride, maybe you're relying too much on a clear counter and not enough on the task at hand. Not sure that's the best solution, but you probably get the idea. So the last point I wanted to make in this lecture was the experiential part. And the quote in the lecture, and depending on how you print them out and how big the type font is, it comes out of different pages, but it's at the end of the section on the reason distortion of withdrawal. What it says is, the most important part of this work is to feel these emotions, to truly experience them. It is impossible to get rid of this life-prohibiting idealized self-image if you merely look on and observe in a detached way with your intellect what is in you. You have to become acutely aware of all these often contradictory trends, and this will be painful. There's a lot of documentaries and films that I collect, and I use them for teaching, but perhaps the truth is I use them for me, and they imbue themselves into me, and I wind up being able to more clearly delineate or talk about a concept because I have a clearer point of view. And one of the documentaries I've got is called A Life Without Pain. And it's a documentary about a disease. A particular child is featured in the documentary. But it's a documentary about a disease that destroys your ability to feel pain. And this disease is life-threatening. People don't live. Because pain is not the... we're not talking about the... We are talking to some degree, but if you take a hammer and you hit your thumb instead of a nail, that's pain. But every day of your life, there's a little bit of discomfort in your body. And without realizing it, what you do is you shift your position or you go to the toilet, or you eat, or you cough, or you sneeze, or you stretch your muscles, or. There's a thousand things you do without even being aware or conscious of it. And these are all reactions to tiny discomforts in the body because the organic system must continue to be fluid. Stasis in an organism equals death. And so when this disease removes the capacity to receive feedback in the form of pain, people die because their bowels don't work, because they don't realize they're running out of oxygen, because they sit catty-corner on their legs, cut off the circulation, and parts of their body die. When they become ill or diseased, the body doesn't know how to react because pain is the signal that starts a lot of physiological processes. So the reason I'm bringing this up is when the guide says you have to become acutely aware of all these contradictory trends and this will be painful. We think in terms of hitting our thumb with a hammer, but the guide is talking about a spiritual level of pain where we are disturbed. We feel discomfort. We feel disquiet. And without that sense of pain, we would not get up on our feet and do something about it. We wouldn't. Just like human beings who don't feel pain do not move their limbs, they are more comfortable and restore the blood circulation. That's why I'm going to go off on a tiny tangent here because I'm a body person. That's why people who have diabetes lose their limbs and have to have their legs amputated, because diabetes kills the nerve ends in the extremities, and eventually the body doesn't work properly. And when the body doesn't work properly in an extremity, that extremity becomes gangrenous. Anyway, it gets gangrene. It begins to rot. And once that sets in, the only thing they can do is lop it off. Spiritually, there's some truth to that. If we have an area of us that becomes painful and we don't deal with it, it will grow. And it will affect our lives. So, yes, it may be painful to see that you're not all you hoped to be. But the deeper message in the guide lectures is you are a child of God. You are a divine being. You are beautiful the way you are. That you're here on this planet because you want to be better. You want to undergo some more transformation. And you've come to this planet and agreed to be this crazy being called a human being because we have such tremendous capacity to access soul distortions and transform them and purify. So that's all I have to say about the lecture. If there's any questions, I'm happy to respond to them. My goodness. A great lecture.
Yeah. One thought that I have, Jen, that this is Leah.
Mm-hmm.
One component that sits in the foundation of each distortion is fear.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to mention that is helpful in seeking those places in the self. And I'm sure you made the connection in other lectures, and I'm here for the first time, but that place, and it was very apparent in a few of the examples you brought, the place where the inner translation goes to life or death and to fear is the place where where we contract and we go into the distortion of whatever attribute it is that would save us, quote unquote.
Yeah. No, that's very true. So the game I play is being somewhat prideful and willful. Oh my God, I forgot to say that, and Leah had to remind me. And what I do with myself is say, why not?
Mm.
Because your voice and the way you express it could say it in a way that somebody could hear it more clearly. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else want to say anything, or shall we consider this done? Going once. Going twice. Well, it's been an hour and a half. I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you for joining me. And I hope, you know, that you'll find value in them and enjoy another one soon. So thanks, everybody, for participating.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you, Jen.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.